From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, voters are deciding who will win an historic gubernatorial race, which ballot items will pass, and which party will control Congress. The focus, of course, is on winning, but there will also be losers. With so much time and effort placed and focused on winning, how does one deal with excruciating public loss? Dr. Seth Norholm is with us. He teaches psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory School of Medicine and specializes in fear and anxiety. Dr. Norholm, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here today.
Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp have been much the national focus of this election and local as well. They each gave up re-election bids to run for governor. So if they lose, their political capital plummets, at least for now. How does someone steel themselves against that kind of loss?
I think in part when somebody makes the decision to run for public office, they have prepared themselves for different outcomes and contingencies. And so I would like to think that each of the candidates has had some time to sit down and think about what they would do if they lost the election. But that doesn't necessarily protect them from the emotional feeling in the moment. So when the election is decided and the results are in, and that individual who is on the losing side must now face the fact that they've lost, there's going to be an emotional reaction. There's going to be anger, tears, frustration. You may not see that in the public. You may not see that on TV. You know, one of the things that you see with political figures is a public face, and there's obviously a personal face that we don't see behind the scenes. You know, sometimes I think we do. I think that veil gets lifted. But what you're going to probably see is a concession speech and saying all the right things about unity and bringing us back together. But there's going to be a period of time behind the scenes of emotionally dealing with the loss and then deciding what the next step is.
Well, we did hear earlier in the hour about the concession speech and how you have to rally and summon that inner, you know, belief in democracy, because it really is about conveying the message that the republic will go on. But that personal thing, I guess this may be true of athletes as well. They're out there putting themselves out there to win. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But politically, it's a whole different thing. Your personhood is out there. Do you think there's a different kind of stake in that?
You know, I think it's really appropriate to use the sports analogy because it works so well in the political scene. A lot of people will say they follow politics and they follow it from the same sort of standpoint as if they were following a sporting event. Obviously with much greater stakes. But this same idea that you need to put forth your best effort, and if you don't, that's seen by potentially millions of people. And so what you need to do is decide how you're going to steel yourself against that. And I think sports also works well if you think about how people identify with their politics. You know, someone may identify with the local sports team because they grew up here in Atlanta. Their father was a Braves fan. Their grandfather was a Braves fan. And if the Braves lose, you feel that personal loss as if I lost.
Hmm.
And the same thing holds true with politics. You know, you follow a candidate, you may campaign, you may volunteer, you put all this emotional effort into it. And if it doesn't work out your way, you know, you need to find a way to cope with that as well.
Yeah, I've actually heard the description of sports fans being like a version of tribalism. I don't know if,
right.
You know, if that word actually applies. But I wonder if it's true also for political candidates or political supporters. There's an identity that's tied up in that.
Exactly. There's an identity tied up in that. There's an identity tied up in who you are in the public face and in the public eye and what you've been doing. And so if you look at, you know, an incumbent politician who's been in the Senate or the Congress for decades, they become synonymous with that institution, whereas somebody who's, you know, a freshman congressman may have more to lose after 2 years of being in office because they haven't had that track record. But you certainly build this identity. And so if it is the case of an incumbent losing their spot, they really do need to find what their post-political identity is. And you see examples of that, you know, in the media, on the cable shows. You'll see former politicians that are now speaking out, you know, Rick Santorum, David Jolly, you know, from both of the political parties respectively, who have found a way to find an identity outside of their political roles.
I would imagine that as a candidate, you're probably going to lose some. You have to learn how to lose. How do we learn how to lose with grace, especially in a culture that's very much the message is it's about winning. You have to win.
Right, exactly. And you learn that very early on as you're brought up in school and in sports, that this idea of winning, you know, as Vince Lombardi said, winning is everything.
And so you don't get a 13th place trophy in politics for showing up.
And so you learn that there's winning and there's losing. But what you really need to do to be psychologically healthy and to approach life in general, whether it's politics, whether it's sports, whether it's your occupation, is to look at it in more of a continuum, you know, not black and white, winning and losing, but this sort of gray area. Was I better today than I was yesterday? Can I be better tomorrow than I am today? So that you look at your successes and failures in the perspective that they should be looked at. So if, for example, Brian Kemp or Stacey Abrams lose tomorrow, you know, it's going to be an opportunity for them to stop and say, okay, what am I going to do next? And one of the things that they can do respectively is look at how far they've come. They may not have achieved the office that they were looking for, but in the case of Stacey Abrams, she was able to rally the support of an Oprah Winfrey, of the former president. In Brian Kemp's case, he has the sitting president who spoke up in this election. You see these opportunities to say, I may not have won this office, but look at all these people that I rallied. And so then you can take a look inward and say, how does that reflect my values? What can I do moving forward from that?
That's the personal stake, but I wonder the nation is watching Stacey Abrams, especially because she could become the first Black female governor. So is there more pressure, thinking that you are carrying, you know, not just the expectations of your party, but all these other parts, the women, the African Americans, all the Latino voters? What comes with that?
Certainly, I would imagine there is added pressure on Stacey Abrams because of what she represents. But I would also expect that you would keep that in mind, you know, depending on the results after today, that you'd be able to say, you know, I have taken not only African-American women, I've taken not only what have been traditionally minorities to a different level. I've made their voice louder. So it becomes a case of weathering the initial storm of, let's say, that it's a loss, and then saying, how can I take what I've achieved and keep moving it forward? And that may be, there are certainly examples of politicians who lost their initial attempt at public office and came back and ran again and won. So it may be a case of giving a concession speech and saying, okay, this was the first try. We learned this, we learned that, but I'm going to move this forward and I'll see you in, you know, 2, 4, 6 years, depending on what office I go for.
We're talking with Dr. Seth Norholm. He deals a lot and studies fear and anxiety, teaches behavioral sciences at Emory. So a real strong or broad spectrum of people who experience fear and anxiety for you. And your research touches on how it's manifest in the digital age. You know, does that speed and the tone and the label of loser being amplified now so quickly, is that harder, do you think, on people emotionally?
Yeah, I certainly think we're in a unique place in history now with the advent of technology and having our smartphones basically give us access to everything from entertainment to news to social media. If you look at what human beings fear and you ask people to list their fears, you know, you'll hear the common ones: public speaking, death and dying, sickness, heights, closed spaces. But what's also unique to people is that we can also play this what-if game. So we can worry and have anxiety about things that are not necessarily a direct threat. And so you'll see that is often played out in the digital media age, where there are potential threats. For example, a few years ago, it was the Ebola virus. And now we've heard a lot of talk about illegal immigration and a potential rise in crime. And this is designed and can increase fear. And so what it's important to do in these situations is to look at the statistics, look at the facts, and really learn what is a threat and what isn't a threat. And so what happens is you've got your social media or you've got your phone open and you're scrolling, and all these events that are happening around the world are right there stacked on top of each other in the news feed. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're all related and they're, you know, snowballing into this great cataclysmic event.
And our brains, as humans, are kind of hardwired to look for those, aren't
exactly.
they? What's going on inside of the, I don't know, limbic system, is it? When we respond to fear like that.
Our fear system is hardwired, as you said, and there's a fight, flight, or freeze response. So if we're hiking in the woods and we come across a snake, we're going to have a fear response to it. And that's going to be regulated a lot by the brain region called the amygdala, which is in the limbic system. And then we also have our frontal cortex, which allows us to gauge the threat and determine whether or not it is actually a threat. So you may immediately have a fight or flight response upon seeing the snake. And so your heart races, you start to perspire, and you start to become aroused. But then you quickly retrieve a memory and you realize, oh, this is just a garden snake. There's no reason to be as worried or scared. And you'll start to calm down biologically. But we only have one fear system. We respond to a venomous snake the same way we would to having to give a job talk. You know, in both cases, you're activating the same system. And the same thing can happen when you're talking about the elections and thinking about not only the outcome of the election, but what's going to happen moving forward. If you start to go down that road and you start to think about what are the effects on education, what are the effects on healthcare, what are the effects on our security, you can trigger the same fear response, panic, arousal systems that are activated by an acute threat like, you know, a predator.
So you were talking about what the candidates have to do to kind of maintain a sense of equilibrium and calm and realize that, well, I've come this far. I've taken these efforts to be a sound, sane person for the most part. How about for those supporters who are all riled up after the election? What do they do with that excess agita?
The supporters really do have to spend some time, if you want to say in the sports analogies, you know, going through a post game and and thinking about where they are at that point. So that means processing the emotions of disappointment, frustration, and loss, processing the emotions of fear and anxiety, and allowing yourself to feel that emotionally. So it may be screaming into a pillow. It may be going for a long run, whatever it is that you need to bleed off that emotion. That's an important step to take. You know, oftentimes it's said that buried emotions are buried alive because they're still there and they need to be processed. So I would encourage supporters to process the emotion they're feeling in the moment. And then the next step is, what am I going to do about it? And that can oftentimes take a few days, could take a few months. But the point is to get to that part. What am I going to do about how I'm feeling right now?
Yeah. You're going to fall. So you have to learn how to pick yourself back up. And we do often hear President Trump, he disparages people and calls them losers or otherwise talks a lot about winning and losing. Here's one of his campaign speeches. This is from 2015 that was recorded by Fox.
We lose everywhere. We lose militarily. We can't beat ISIS. Give me a break. We can't beat anybody. Our vets are being treated horribly. It will change. We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning. Believe me, I agree. You'll never get bored with winning. We never get bored.
We're talking about the psychology of losing, but how about winning? Can that go to a person's head, the kind of cockiness that it becomes almost addictive, that the fear of losing becomes more powerful than the desire to serve?
Certainly. And I think you're seeing a few things there. You're seeing the fear of losing being a motivating factor. So you're going to do whatever you can within your power and within the resources you have available to you to make sure that you win and to protect yourself from what would happen if you lost. And if you are successful and you repeatedly experience what we in society call wins, that can build your self-esteem, that can build your ego. And then if you add on top of that the adoration and the support that you get from these screaming crowds, that can certainly lead to an overconfidence, can lead to, you know, making decisions and making statements that you may not be able to follow up on with this over-exaggerated sense of confidence. And so it's another situation where there need to be checks on that. There need to be reminders of what the possible consequences are and things like that.
A lot of people are talking about like teaching their kids how to make mistakes and to lose every now and again. Is that something you think we could all stand to learn how to lose gracefully and pick ourselves back up?
Yes, I think those are what we call teachable moments. And those are situations where, yes, there are opportunities to learn what it feels like to lose and to feel at your lowest and then pick yourself up from that. And what that does is not only does it help you in that situation there, let's say it's coming in second instead of first in one of your swim meets, or it's not performing well on an exam and feeling like you've quote unquote lost. and asking yourself, how am I going to address this differently? And more time in the pool, if it's a swimming analogy, or more time studying. And I think that's been somewhat lost more recently. You know, there's this debate about participation trophies and youth sports, and there being less of a discrimination between those who perform really well and those who just perform. If you look back historically, there was a class valedictorian who was the quote-unquote best student in the class, and then there was the rest of them. And you learned that, okay, this person has outperformed me. How can I improve whatever areas of my life I want to improve? And I think that somewhat gets muted in more recent times. But I think some of that has to do with social media and this idea that you can get immediate gratification, but you can get, you know, likes, you can get more friend requests. And these add this idea of winning, 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 when in reality, it's not an accurate measure of who's winning and who's losing.
Any closing advice to On Second Thought listeners who might feel anxious about the elections or want to learn how to just cope with loss?
Yeah, I think the best advice is to allow yourself to experience the emotions that you're going through, to recognize that you're going to feel worse today than tomorrow. So the feelings that you have, whether it's anger, frustration, sadness, it's going to feel bad today, but it will get better over time. We know that. I would encourage people to reach out to social support, their network of friends and family, to know that whatever they're going through post-election, they don't have to do alone. And certainly if somebody has an extended period of time where they're sad, depressed, you know, or even desperate, depending on how much emotional stake they put into this election, to seek out professional help.
Dr. Seth Norholm, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seth Norholm teaches psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory School of Medicine. He also works for Atlanta's VA Medical Center. And that is it for our show for today. There will be winners and losers, but, you know, wait around. That always flips. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer. Don Smith is our script editor, and let's call him Dean of Grammar. And Amy Kiley is senior producer. You can join the conversation. We will be with you throughout the day on gpbnews.org. We're on Facebook and on Twitter at OST Talk. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until tomorrow, which will come, thanks for spending some time with us today for On Second Thought.